Welcome to another episode of Pacific Underground, your show about the Asian American and Pacific Islander experience.
Good morning. I'm Jake Ramos.
And I'm Tabitha Teo.
And on this episode, we bring you an interview we have with some artists that are showing at the Portland Chinatown Museum.
Their current art exhibition is called Descendant Threads, and it's a group show featuring three Asian American female artists working and living in and around Portland. Jake, did you see the show?
Yes, I was actually there at the opening reception for the show with you and producer Jenna several weeks ago on First Thursday, and I thought it was really good. There was good crowd there, and it was really neat to see the difference in Roberta and Lynn and Ellen's work. And they were all very, really strong pieces. And the Vincent Chin shrine was really powerful for me because I was really young when that incident happened, and it was very sort of early formation to me because I hadn't really puzzled out what it meant to be Asian American yet, but I remember hearing about it. And several of Roberta's pieces were really powerful too. I loved the piece with the Q cut off at the cleaver, and several other ones. And I really liked Lynn's shrine with the family shrine in the video as well, but I didn't get to, because there was so many people in attendance, which was a good problem to have, I didn't get to hear the audio of her multimedia presentation. So, but overall, it was really good.
I thought it was a great show too. Very thoughtful. I thought all the artists put a lot of thought and time into their pieces. I also heard it was the first group show in Portland featuring Asian American women.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. But if so, it's definitely long overdue.
Yeah.
considering Asian Americans are the largest minority group in Portland, I believe. Are they? Maybe not. One of the largest. And the show is also curated by another longtime Portland Asian American artist and curator, Horatio Law, who I met and chatted with for the first time at the reception.
I had the pleasure of sitting down with two of the artists, Roberta Wong and Lynn Yarn, to talk about their show and their work currently on exhibition.
Oh, great. Let's listen to that.
Let's first introduce ourselves. I am Tabitha Teo, and I am here with two artists who have work at the Portland Chinatown Museum right now. Can you please introduce yourselves?
My name is Roberta Wong. I'm a visual artist doing conceptual and installation art.
And my name is Lynn Yarn.
These two artists have work up right now at the Portland Chinatown Museum called Descendant Threads, and it is up through November 11th. Unfortunately, we are not joined by one of the artists, Ellen George, but we are joined by Lynn Yarn and Roberta Wong. So thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
What kind of statement or message are you trying to make with your art?
Let's see, I think early on in the process, I was thinking more about feeling. I kind of wanted a feeling of, I don't know, walking into like a warm, cozy room, but something kind of mysterious, but something joyful and grateful or thankful, I think were the feelings I was going for. All of the pictures that are inside of the altar are family photos or kind of places that are talked about in the interviews that I collected. And so I wanted a feeling of kind of like a warmth when you look at the photos or kind of wondering more about them and like feeling like myth and reverence.
So my work is a collection of work that I've done since 1985, and usually they're focused on themes of injustice and race and sometimes gender. And the earliest piece I have there was produced in 1985. It's called All Orientals Look Alike, and it's a statement about, again, stereotypes and using or asking the viewer to use the title to frame the work. We're looking at a funerary setting of four individual portraits of different ethnic Asians, and from them, a composite image of all their features that represents the myth of who we're supposed to look like. So with some humor as well as with some solemnness, I want the audience to contemplate the impact of that statement and the reality of the loss imposed by stereotypes. And so it's set in a funerary setting with candles and offerings on the table, and a memory of our home and our own little altar that we would have displayed a photograph of our grandfather, and on those occasions, you know, again, pouring him a little cup of whiskey and offering chicken and rice. Mm-hmm. But as part of the exhibit, none of the food is there, but because of the environment it's in, they don't allow food in a museum setting. But that's the earliest piece, and unfortunately it's still relevant, and we still have to address those issues. The most recent piece I produced was a piece that I've carried around in my head for a while. It's in memory of Vincent Chin, who was a victim of racial violence. And it's been probably a generation ago where his story was told, and it's time for new generations to learn his story and be reminded of, again, the challenges that we have as a race to deal with just blind prejudice.
Yeah, I have to say that I've seen the exhibit, and I think all both of yours and Ellen's works are just so powerful in what they say. And Roberta, I didn't know that your All Orientals Look Alike piece was a little over 30 years old now. That's really cool.
The first time it was displayed at the Chinese Benevolent Association Hall, where you have the traditional photographs of past presidents lined up against the wall, and this installation was just below that. So I wasn't quite sure how the Chinese community would respond to it, you know, but they actually were very positive about it, and also could understand the message that it conveyed, and didn't take offense to it. Although I've heard other interpretations of the image or of the piece being one of violence, because the central image is composite of strips of the photographs that are interwoven, but someone mistook it to be cut with the dagger through the central image. So they thought someone had, you know, again, inflicted violence on the center image, as opposed to my thought of interweaving the four individual people to shatter the stereotype. Mm-hmm. So it's always interesting to me how people can interpret information, and my interest is not to control that response, but just to embrace that humanity that people feel about their subjects, because it's everyone's feelings are valid, and you have to have respect for that, even though you may not agree with that thought, but you have to step back and kind of think of where that's coming from.
Mm-hmm. What do you think you want people to take away from your work?
I did think a lot about this, but I think I wanted to commit to making a work for myself. It sounds a little bit selfish, but I think, you know, when you make something like Roberta, you're saying, like, everyone's feelings, everyone will get something different from a piece, mm-hmm. and those feelings are all valid. And so I felt like if I tried to do something authentic and genuine to myself, that maybe it might like resonate with someone else. I'm a high school teacher during the day, and last year when I first started kind of the work that led up to this project, I was co-teaching an ethnic studies class, and it was a lot of work, emotionally especially, like mm-hmm. in a classroom of, it started with 60 kids of varying degrees of caring about race and racism in our country or in general. So it was really exhausting, kind of always thinking about making stuff for others. And I mean, we teach for our own selves and like happiness also, but I think at the end of the day, I wanted to go home and work on something for myself as like a healing project.
I think you succeeded too.
Oh, thank you.
I think you had a lot of people look at the images and share their own memories of that time. And I think reflection is an important part of that process of healing. So it's nice that the people have time to spend in there as long as they choose, and just in even multiple times, and get different details from that experience. And you're welcome. And in the same way, my work, I try to capture a sense of reality and truth, and I believe both those elements are multifaceted, that you only can see a part of something from one perspective, and it's when you comprehend more about that circumstance or experience, you can hopefully gain another facet of that, of information from that piece. And so I consider each piece a threshold of reality, and then my expectation is that the audience will walk through that with me, as opposed to stand on the outside and look in. That as a piece of art, as an installation piece, my expectation is that it shares a part of my life, my perspective, without words. That often some of these experiences, there are no words to express, you know, what you've gone through, and only visceral experience of walking through or walking that path, can you understand and comprehend someone else's experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, Roberta, I wanted to ask you about the piece with the hair.
Mm-hmm.
Like how you came up with that, or like what were your experiences that again, led to that?
That piece is called All American, and it deals with hyphenated Americans. So regardless of what culture you're coming from, to be American, you have to usually leave something behind, and sometimes it's overt, like the cutting of your hair in queue, or sometimes it's invisible, that you don't see that the loss that someone has gone through to be here and to be part of this culture. And I don't have a particular process that I utilize for these pieces, but it comes to me visually. Again, as a conceptual artist, my studio I carry around in my head. I don't have a physical space where I work, mm-hmm. And I only execute them when I have an opportunity to show it. And so, again, being Chinese American, being from a family of immigrants, you know, these experiences are always on your mind. And So again, the piece is a simple piece. I grew up in a kitchen, so there's an element of that that's in the piece. It's I use a stainless steel table with a round wooden chopping block and a heavy Chinese cleaver embedded into the block. And from that, the edge of that blade is my hair, my braid, a cue that represents maybe Chinese Americans from the early 18th, 19th century, where that was part of their image to have their cue attached. But to assimilate in America, most of the men had cut theirs off.
Some of them had their cues forcibly cut off when there was such anti-Chinese immigration sentiment in America.
That's true. They didn't often have a choice. Mm-hmm. So I think about, you know, what they had to go through and what they experienced. And in many ways, today's immigrants, you know, go through that same process psychologically as well as physically and mentally. And, you know, we may not see what they've had to sacrifice, but you know they're in pain. You know, there's a pain that goes with that transition. So thank you for, again, I'm just, I don't know if you can, understanding or appreciating that piece.
I really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. I feel when people first see it, it's very striking.
Yeah.
Like it's people stop.
Yeah, yeah. It's not an easy image to look at, I don't think. I mean, to have a bodily part on a chopping block, mm-hmm. yeah. And unfortunately, we have a recent image to consider with Mr. Kosagi,
the journalist that yes. died in Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
Yeah,
in terms of Chinese history, eye for an eye, tooth. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you see images, you know, of people losing parts mm-hmm. of their body because if they've executed a crime, so their hand comes off, things like that.
Do any of you think of yourself as hyphenated Americans? Because, like, even though my ethnicity is Chinese, I am strangely much more comfortable thinking of myself as Asian American than Chinese American. And it could be a generational thing, but I'm curious how do y'all think of yourself?
Because I'm Chinese and Japanese American, I think Asian American is just easier to say. And so maybe I use that more. I also think that maybe like the experience of like internment camp is very like part of our family's experience, or like the Exclusion Acts and how my family lived in America, or like their path to me. So I think I do say Asian American more.
I think to claim yourself as Asian American is more inclusive. It speaks to the fact that we're not seen as individuals, but and also it's a step away from the romanticism perhaps of Chinese culture, Japanese culture, or you know, Filipino or Vietnamese, and because there is an element of romanticism that people look at these cultures, mm-hmm. And I think so. Asian American being more modern term, that you're removing yourself from that bias again, that expectation of who you are based on your ethnicity. And so I think I identify as Asian American, but I know I'm Chinese, you know, in my heritage. And so it's a question of who you're relating to, if you're relating to family versus, you know, a community. And having attended just recently the Apanos East Side, East Portland Arts and Literary mm-hmm. Festival, you know, those definitions aren't necessarily defined. You're in a group of fellow Asians, and some are maybe Chinese, some are Japanese, some are Filipino and Vietnamese, and but there is a connectedness that we have and we share by being identified as Asian American.
Hmm. This question just occurred to me, and I guess it's kind of a silly fluff question. How do you store your work when it's not on display? Because Lynn, your altarpiece, it's like a tiny room. So just take up your living room and it's not on display.
Goodness. My parents were really nice. I built it with my dad, which was probably like the best part of doing the project, mm-hmm. just getting to hang out and like talk shop. And but as we were kind of building it bit by bit, he was like, oh, this is going to be in the garage for a while, huh? And I'm like, yeah, sorry. So I think when I dismantle it, I need to figure out a plan because it's going to show again in January. Mm. So I have to store it somewhere till January. But it'll be in different pieces.
Mm. Where do you plan to show it?
It'll be showing at Open Signal.
Oh,
so
okay, great.
Open Signal supported me with a fellowship this summer, which is how I put most of it. And then the kind of phase two project is I'm developing some curriculum at school, kind of related. So I'm hoping to project the work of my students. I haven't decided which class, kind of alongside it and with it in a room.
How long will it be up at Open Signal?
Mid-January through mid-February. I think cool. It goes up on the 15th.
Great.
Cool. Roberta, how do you store your work?
They live in little boxes, basically. I have my boxes of books that I keep in the garage, basically, and they come out. But they're identified by color, so it makes it easy for me to assemble them based on their identification. And these days, plastic boxes are great for my other installations where I can actually see what's inside and not get them mixed up. But yeah, that's a convenient way to store these items. Mm-hmm. They don't see the light of day very frequently, so it's good to keep them where they're dust-free and, you know, out of the light and mm-hmm. keep it for a longer term that way.
So I had the privilege of helping you set up your chinks piece, which, to describe it, it's a wall of books set in a semicircle around a desk and a wall map. I had the privilege of helping you set up the wall of books. But then there was a part where you came over and rearranged my books, and I felt like, oh, I messed up. I'm sorry.
Not at all. I appreciate your help. And the challenge always with that piece is to make sure you have a good foundation, because if it's not tended to make sure it's secure, it can easily be unstable and could possibly fall over on top of someone. So to prevent that, I just had to make sure that I had a secure base for the piece. And I also, at the time, I was, I usually put the books in a color order. And in the past, I've had red, white, and blue separated. And I wasn't sure if I was going to keep the same sequence of colors. So after the fact, after we got to the level that you had helped me with, I decided I was going to revert back to the previous color order. So in some ways, it was my undecidedness about that issue. But
if that's just your polite way of saying you screwed up.
No, not at all. No, not at all. And actually, the layer, the books are comprised of encyclopedias, the first layer being our own family set of encyclopedias. And I've frequented the Goodwill bins to collect the multitude of encyclopedias that represent the multitude of families that have come to America to seek a world-class education. But as I build the wall, I create chinks in the wall. And the piece is titled Chinks, number 3. And it was given that title to underscore not only the derogatory term that's been applied to Chinese Americans, but also to highlight the voids that exist in our education system, void of any multicultural reference or cultures when I was going to school. And I'm a student of the 60s, 70s, and so I think multiculturalism didn't really come into play until maybe the 80s, mm-hmm. where it started being maybe part of the curriculum being considered as... Well,
I was a student like in the 90s and early aughts, and I feel like I still had a pretty lacking of multi-ethnic education, like outside of African-American history. Yeah, I feel like there was a lot of Asian-American history that I didn't learn about, that I had to seek out on my own.
Mm-hmm. It's still an issue.
So,
Lindsay, as an educator.
But, yeah, as a high school teacher, I hope you're...
yeah.
Well, at the top layer of the wall, though, are more current books that historians have tried to fill the voids with. So there's a reference in, and even top layers that you can kind of finger through if you're curious to see some of the material there.
So it's also an interactive piece.
It can be, yes.
I like
Very
that.
Ginger, yeah. And then behind the wall is an old school map. As I recall my memory of being a student, they never talked about China because China was a communist country. So here I'd always wait for them to maybe point to China or talk about China, and that was never the case for my classroom. And then also behind the student desk, or on top of the student desk behind the wall, are the stereotypical books that we have been come to be known by, with books about cowboys and Indians and Christopher Columbus and the Catholic Bible, or not Catholic, the Catholic Book of History. So it's again a skewed history, mm-hmm. as well. But in the desk and on the kind of on the seat, there's references to books you kind of hide and take for yourself, you know, that you read for yourself, but Black Like Me and books about protests. But mm-hmm. But just to, again, maybe show some intent on this part of the student to educate themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's a piece that it took maybe three renditions to actually materialize this particular piece.
And that's why it's called Chinks 3.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I had thought of other forms that it could be presented, but this is the only one that I've actually executed.
Mm.
So that's that piece.
I sort of hate this question because it's very cliched when talking to artists, but what inspires you? Or where do you get your ideas from?
My one was a lot about being inspired. Part of the piece is kind of spliced together interviews. It's about an hour in total, which is maybe a little bit long for a piece, but it's 10 different elders from Chinatown and Japantown, or who frequented the area in their lifetime. I was really inspired by their stories. I was inspired by kind of learning more about my own family history. I also got really inspired, like, working with so many different people, like meeting Roberta and Ellen and getting to know Horatio more. I got to work with the Legacy Center a little bit, the Nikkei Legacy Center, and work with some of the photos and collections from Jackie at the Chinatown Museum. And all the people at Open Signal there are really fantastic and generous, and, you know, are trying to support artists. And I think that part really inspired me. And so I think as I was making stuff, even though I said I, you know, was trying to focus on a healing project, I wanted, I don't know, inspiration from others to be very present in the work.
It's hard to, I can say that what inspired me was my last year going to PSU. I had started knowing that I wanted to be an artist, so straight out of high school, I took all my classes and sequences and all those things, but I could never get through art history. So eventually I took a break, and it was when I returned, I came back and I took a course by Mel Katz, who is a professor there, and he offered a class called Current Concerns, and that introduced me. I was a sculpture major, and that's what I majored in. So I was exploring conceptual art, which was outside of my realm. And there were books that we could peruse and look through. And Chris Burden was an artist that I responded to. And what I interpret him trying to do, at least in that phase of his life, was to address complacency in our society. And he had created works that would force people to respond or to react to his presence. And one example was, he had a gallery exhibit, and you walk in, the space is void of anything. So, but up above the door entrance, he built a platform that he sat upon and shouted obscenities to people to literally drive them out of the space. And that was his, again, one of his pieces. And then a second piece, he had locked himself into a school locker, and he had a bottle of and a tube that he can urinate into that was outside the door of the locker. And and again, his actions had provoked administration to get a blowtorch and get him out of there. And so I think he was successful in again, provoking people's behavior. But the one piece specific to Portland was going to be exhibited at the Portland Center for Visual Arts, PCVA. His piece involved basically two objects, an empty chair, and opposite that chair was a loaded revolver. And the revolver was set on a timer, so you didn't know when it was going to go off. A person would have to sign a waiver if they were going to sit down in that chair. And so, again, the anticipation of facing a life and death situation was what he was offering, again, to his audience and viewer. But after a lot of deliberation, the board chose not to put themselves...
exhibit that piece.
At risk. And so, but the concept of the piece is what's powerful. The fact that it wasn't executed was beside the point. You know, he, again, offered an exhibit that they had to reject. And so, again, shaking the art world again up.
Sounds like your professor was quite the provocateur.
Well, it wasn't his work. It was the work of Chris Burden.
Oh, okay.
And again, and I appreciated what his work was trying to do to address complacency and provoke human response, but I chose not to do it in that form. I felt his work was more egotistical and masochistic, that I chose not to, that I kind of disdained that. But but I felt what he was doing is powerful, and so I tried to find a way to do that in a more humane way. And so that's kind of the basis of most of my pieces, even as diverse as they are in terms of what they address and what form they take. I'm hoping that it will affect the viewers in the same way that I do believe change happens internal. To be permanent and to have, you know, an impact on one's life, it has to be internal change. You know, you can make physical, you change your routine or something like that, but when you're impacted physically, and it's you can't help but walk away with that feeling, and you can't lose that feeling when you experience something that's affects you in a certain way, mentally or physically. You carry it with you, and that was the intent of actual conceptual art as well. It was sort of antithesis of the commerciality of work, of artwork, and the belief that if you understand something, it's yours. You can own it. You can share it. It's free. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have the capacity to understand something, and there's no price tag. You know, really.
So I notice on the show flyer that this is the first group show by Asian American women artists. And I know the curator is Horatio Law. I'm curious, like, how did this process get started? How long was the, like, development process? Who contacted who first? Who came up with the idea?
Basically, with the museum opening, Jackie had invited Horatio to curate an exhibit. And when I asked Horatio about his process, he was relating the fact that as he was raised by his mother as a single parent, and he holds a lot of reverence for her hard work and ability to take care of him and his siblings, and so he wanted to again honor his mother as well by honoring Asian American women artists, and the fact that in Chinese society women are often not given the recognition, or I don't know what it's like another good word, but
credits.
They're not acknowledged, yeah, for what the labor that they go through, and so it was his way of again honoring his mother, and in the fact that the museum is devoted to promoting Asian American artists, the fact that we're three women artists makes that statement correct and true. There are other Asian women who have exhibited as artists, and Ellen herself is represented by PDX Gallery. But they're not shown in that context because the nature of the space doesn't define it that way, define the artist that way necessarily. When I was at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, and I got to work with different artists, and the gallery there at IFCC was to promote ethnic artists, and so artists who chose to exhibit with us accepted that fact that they're wanting to be presented in that context, whereas there are some artists who are artists of color who choose not to be presented as an artist of color. They want to be an artist, accepted as an artist first and foremost, and that their ethnic background should not have any impact on that.
This is actually the first show or first thing that I've shown where like heritage or race is part of the work.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, it was all things where it wasn't visually noticeable that like you could.
There wasn't any reference.
Yeah, it wasn't a reference.
Mm-hmm.
I think I thought a lot, especially when you were talking about the Chinks project, I thought a lot about like who gets to represent or who's empowered to represent, what like opportunities provide themselves for representation. And I think more lately, the project that led up to this one was I was trying to remix National Geographic magazine. So I got this big stack from school that were all 50s Geographic ones. And I cut out all the Asian people I could find and then remixed them into gods as like a project. So that was kind of the precursor to this project. Instead of being represented by others and always being seen as others, like, I don't know, representing and like, I get to put my grandma's face everywhere on a in a gallery space. And
oh, that's cool. Yeah. Did you all know each other before Horatio contacted you or know this, of each other?
This is the first time I've met Lynn, but actually Lynn's father and I are schoolmates. Oh. We went to high school together, and so it's a pleasure to meet Lynn. She's a delightful person, and look forward to seeing more of her artwork.
Thanks. I was really excited to meet these two. We had like a coffee, and originally there was one more artist, Valerie Otani, who I knew because I know her family from growing up. But I felt really special to be at a table of like all these cool artists who are doing it and being fantastic. So. Are you an artist, Tabitha?
Yes. Cool. I've never exactly publicly exhibited my art, but I really like textile art. Cool. So I do a lot of sewing, a lot of cross stitching. I'm actually working on this one cross stitch right now of Minoru Yasui. Cool. And it sort of inspired me to do this series of cross stitches of photographs of Asian American activists.
I love it.
I'm just right now doing it for myself, and I don't know if I'll ever exhibit it. And also, at the same time, I feel like I am not necessarily doing anything quote-unquote new with just doing a straight cross-stitch translation of these photographs. Because I just use this pattern-generating website to just run the photograph through, and it just generates a cross-stitch pattern.
I've never seen someone do that before.
Yeah, but I feel like it's just such a straight translation from photograph to cross-stitch patterns. Like, I don't know what new or different I'm trying to say. Or
I love it. Like, as an action, it's like a meditation on that person and what that means.
Yeah, I do find cross-stitching very meditative. And has certainly inspired me to like research about these people's lives, and I feel like in a way everything you do is kind of selfish, and so I've also tried to think like what about their work, like how I could apply it to my life or how I could use it to sort of like inspire and drive my life. So that's the kind of artwork that I'm working on right now.
That's cool.
Thank you.
Well, the one thing that I would add to that conversation is that I believe we're all original. No one can do what you do. And so I give you more power to do it.
Thank you.
Yeah. No one can see something the way you visualize it. And so, you know, it's something I think that if we adhere to our own vision, it'll have more strength. Mm-hmm. You won't be compromising yourself in that way.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you all very much. And once again, no problem. Thanks for being here. And once again, that show will be up at the Portland Chinatown Museum in downtown Portland till November 11th.
All right. Well, thank you, Roberta and Lynn. That was a great conversation. What was your favorite thing about speaking with Roberta and Lynn? Anything new that you learned?
At the end, this caught me a little off guard, but Lynn asked if I was an artist, and I talked about what I was working on at the moment, and they gave me some really nice words of encouragement, and also that I learned that like inspiration can really come from anywhere. Maybe I'll have an exhibition someday.
Yeah, that would be great, like a Yayoi Kusama infinity room with an infinity of chihuahuas.
Oh my god.
Anyways, but yeah, that's great. Thanks for sharing that. We also have a special segment that we're sharing this week, a Vox Pop from this event that the Pacific Underground Collective got to table at a couple weeks ago.
Producers Jenna, Kat, and I got to table at the second annual East Portland Arts and Literary Festival, or EPALF, and it was put on by Apano. I saw you there at the festival several times. You were too busy to sit at our table. What were you doing for EPALF?
Yeah, sorry I was running around the whole time. But you got to admit, the name EPALF, it just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
But I was lucky to be the main stage curator this year for EPALF and last year.
Oh, cool. What'd you do for them?
So as main stage curator, I booked all the main stage performances and poetry readings, stand-up comedy shows, the opening panel, and the two dance performances, and hosted several of those, but mostly got everybody lined up, and it was a good performance. Did you get to catch any of the performances this year, or were you tabling the whole time?
I went to the opening on Friday, and I saw one of the performances and listened to one of the talks that was there on Friday. But I wanted to get ready to table on Saturday, so I left the reception early on Friday. But sadly, on Saturday, I was at the table all day because someone was too busy doing EPAL stuff. So I didn't get to see any of the workshops, unfortunately, or any of the performances. I got to see the poetry reading, and that was because that was moved out tabling area, which I appreciated. But it was nice to listen to the poetry.
That's great.
The festival theme of mental health was very interesting to me. How was that theme decided on?
That came from Apano's Arts and Media Collective that organized the EPALF. The general group narrowed down the festival theme out of several different choices. And we thought, since it's very relatable to many different parts of the community, it was something that has a stigma about being talked about. So we thought, given the state of the world, it's good to kind of consider mental health and talk about these things as a community.
While we were at EPALF, we brought a field recorder along with us and asked folks that stopped by our table about their experiences with mental health. Some people had some really interesting stories to share. Let's take a listen to those. Do you have a mental health story or experience or an opinion about the mental health system?
I think I've always struggled with my mental health, and I think that stems a lot from the expectations that I've not only put on myself, but I've also felt from society, kind of to be, I've been reflecting on this a lot, the idea of being like a perfect Asian. I kind of grew up with that and internalized that in a lot of ways. And so I think even now, it's taken me this long to finally start coming to terms with that and to start trying to incorporate and internalize more self-care into my daily life. I think we really neglect in the Asian American community a lot of folks who are struggling, and I think it's time that we recognize these things and we really put a lot of effort into helping folks who are struggling.
I think I have a lot of loved ones who don't get the help they need and resources they need to help them with their mental health, and I think the system that we live under treats mental health very poorly and not as a necessity. The mental health care that is given to people is pretty low quality unless you have like the money and the means to afford something better, and mental health can be really crippling, and I think there needs to be some better resources and funding and attention and care for mental health and people suffering from.
I can only talk from personal experience. You know, I'm someone who gets my health care from my employer, so I feel very privileged in that sense. But I also feel like, I mean, working within that health care plan, it's just tough. It's tough to know who to, like, trust in terms of, like, is this person going to be right for me? You know, like, do they have a lens that is specific to, like, POC, for people who do social justice work, for people who have certain needs? And it's just like, where do you go, you know? And I feel lucky enough that there are groups that try to cultivate those lists. And I know a number of groups in Portland who really try hard to be like, this person, if you need therapy, like, they would be someone who'd support you and stuff. So I've been trying to navigate that, but it's difficult. It's challenging in the sense that you get discouraged easily when, like, there's just so many obstacles, and taking that first step is really hard.
Well, when I was 20 years old, I unexpectedly got pregnant while I was in college, and that experience of getting unintentionally pregnant with a partner that I didn't really want to go forward with, I decided to terminate a pregnancy when I was really young. And that experience put me in a very downward spiral in my life, I would say. And because of that experience, and it was also a very secretive experience, I was very alone, it was a very dark time. I can count on one hand the people that knew my experience. And so I was very alone with nowhere to turn. And I decided, like, after a year of crying and just deep depression for my decisions, I decided to get some counseling. And that was one of the best decisions I ever made in my life in terms of actively trying to get mentally, I don't know if the word is healthy, but just trying to deal with my issues in a really healthy way. And I really support and advocate for those who are dealing with some of these really big things in your life, whether it's parents or situations or just feeling naturally down and depressed, to talk to someone and get that counseling support. Because for me, I would not be in a space right now if I didn't get that support over several years of just talking to someone. And what I did is actually dream therapy, which was really helpful because I have very vivid dreams, and my counselor took those dreams and helped me navigate my internal issues through my dreams.
The first time that I ever felt like I could tell my mom that I had sought counseling was after my dad passed, pretty tragically and pretty quickly. Her first reaction was, "Oh my God, what is wrong with you? Are you okay?" Like, there was something seriously wrong with me. I was able to take a breath and say, you know, I think that mental health should be treated like physical health. We should really take preventative measures and do check-ins and check-ups before something serious happens and we end up in a crisis or emergency room. And also, we all just went through this huge trauma together. My dad passed, your husband passed, and we're dealing with your cancer as well. So we're just spinning in all kinds of ways. And this is one other way that I can get help to support me and us through navigating all of these challenges.
Thank you to everybody that contributed to that Vox Pop.
I had a great time at ePath and would love to go again next year, either as a tabler or maybe as an attendee.
Yeah, hope you can catch one of the workshops. Those were really great this year. Last year, we only had one workshop, and this year we were able to put on 6 of them and reach many people in the community.
Yeah, there was a sewing workshop that I was really interested about, but I was at the table.
Next, we'll bring you a segment we haven't done in a while, talking about API events happening around Portland.
There are always so many interesting things happening around Portland, and it's important to show support for the API community here in Portland.
So here's a short list of some things that are happening around town over the next couple weeks.
This evening at 6 p.m. at Apano at 2788 Southeast 82nd Avenue, they're having a ballot party. Bring your ballot and fill it out in a fun atmosphere. And the event is free.
I'll have to do that. I haven't filled my ballot out yet.
Shame.
I know.
I did it at EPAL.
And also, on the next night, Saturday the 3rd, DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid will be spinning combination of Latin American and Indian pop music at their Tropital show at the Goodfoot, which is at 2845 Southeast Stark. There'll be an $8 cover for anybody age 21 and over.
Wednesday, November 14th, there will be a screening of the documentary, The Numbers, about the East Portland neighborhood called The Numbers. It'll be at Canton Grill at 2610 Southeast 82nd Avenue at 6 p.m. After the screening, there will be a Q&A with the filmmakers, Sika Stanton and Donovan Smith. There will also be a live performance by Manny Lopez. The event is free.
And then on November 22nd, which is a Tuesday, the Lansu Chinese Gardens at 239 Northwest Everett Street are having a community free day and food drive. So please, if you bring a non-perishable food item, you can get free admission to the gardens, which is normally kind of expensive. And donations go to the Oregon Food Bank in honor of Thanksgiving and folks who don't have enough, I guess.
And Giving Tuesday.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, folks. This has been another episode of Pacific Underground.
And you can find us on Facebook and Instagram if you want to keep up with the latest Pacific Underground news.
Thank you to KWU for the studio space and time. Tune in the day after Thanksgiving for our next episode.
Until then, take care.